Please remain standing for the reading of the gospel. Our gospel text this morning comes from Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. Mark 5, 1 through 20. Hear now the gospel of Jesus Christ. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tomb a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told in the city and the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. The grass withers and the flower fades. Please be seated. Our text today was just read, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. And I truly love this passage. I love it for its strangeness. I love it for its rawness. I love it because it subverts. I love it because of its ever-present practicality. I love it because of the way that it shows me Jesus. Many of you know that for me, literature has been such a helpful sidecar, such a helpful companion in my studies of the scripture. I feel in a profound way that God is always imperceptibly sort of using all the things that I have read to help me to pause before scripture and meditate in places that I would normally rush over. And I remember the first time that I started to see the passage that we read today. And I mean the first time I really saw it on more than a superficial glossing. And that first time that I saw this passage, it came after I was reading a novel by Cormac McCarthy called Outer Dark. Outer Dark. This is one of the less popular, less critically acclaimed novels of that towering figure of American literature, the one who just recently passed away some year or two ago. He published that book, Outer Dark, in 1993. And because of what it did for me, I think it's my favorite McCarthy novel. Now, I'm not sure I'd recommend it to any of you or to my general audience. Although I love it, it is, as the title suggests, extraordinarily dark. Outer Dark. The novel is saturated with biblical imagery, starting with the title itself. And Jesus tells the parable of the wedding feast in Matthew 22, which ends with these horrifying words, the horrifying words of the king, the good king, who says this: "Bind him hand and foot and cast him into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen." Well, there's this scene towards the end of the novel where a bunch of pigs are running along a cliff above the gray serpentine of the river below. The hogs, they start to panic, and they begin leaping off the cliff. And the pig herders, they start to assume these satanic looks, as if they were not true swineherds, but instead they were disciples of darkness, herding the pigs to their inevitable doom. It's an obvious reference to our text today, which made the young me realize that I had missed the whole point of the McCarthy novel. And it drove me back to this text, and then I read this text and realized I had missed the whole point of this text. So the moral of the story is I think I just miss a lot. I miss a lot. So let's set the scene here, because I think often we miss this text. We saw last week Jesus has just calmed the sea. He has just brought peace and order and stability. He has accomplished his work, and yet we're not fully out of the woods. There is still danger until the time of the second coming. As we have said by way of analogy before, the time that we live in is that time between D-Day and VE Day. It's a good analogy. That's why it's worth using multiple times. We live between D-Day, the storming of the beaches of Normandy, which for all intents and purposes ended World War II. It was over. There was no coming back for the Axis powers in Europe after D-Day. But the time between D-Day, Normandy, and VE Day, victory in Europe, is still a very dangerous time. A lot of people lose their lives, even though the battle had been won. And that's the time that we live in, the time between D-Day and VE Day. So Jesus, he calms the seas. Victory. Or so we think. He then comes across the Sea of Galilee. He comes out of the east side of the sea, where there rises the great Golan Heights, which was, and still is to this day, as you follow the news, very disputed territory. It was disputed territory in Jesus' day. You know that Israeli-Palestinian conflict that did not start last October. For years and years, the Golan Heights were part of Syria. Israel, they only took the territory in the war of 1967. That's pretty recently. And that's only 20 years after the UN came in, after the atrocities of World War II, and carved Israel out of the state of Palestine. After all saying these Jews, they need a homeland, they need a place to go, in light of what had just happened with Hitler. But all this is to say this. International and especially Middle Eastern politics and land disputes are deep-rooted. They are complicated. They are intricate. They are complex. And the politics of Jesus' day were every bit as complex. If you remember a few weeks back when we talked about the calling of Matthew, we saw that Herod the Great, he divided his territory. And he divided it in King Lear fashion amongst his three sons. Well, this story, the one that we have today, it takes place in the region to the southeast of Galilee, where Herod's son Philip now had control. It takes place in the land that the Jews never controlled. So it's important to note that now as far as our geopolitics. Even in this day, the Jews did not control this territory. It's a land called the Decapolis. You see that in verse 20 of our text. Deca means 10. That's why we have the Decalogue, which is the 10 commandments, the Deca Logos, the 10 words or the 10 commandments. And here we have the Deca, the 10, polis. Polis is the Greek word for city-states. So we're in the land of the 10 city-states. Now take a second for a moment. Imagine the intricate complexities in regards to property rights, border disputes, when you have 10 different people groups with different heritage, different backgrounds, all claiming that this is their land, all living together, intermingled. And then on top of that, Imperial Rome comes in with their Roman legions and they subjugate the whole lot. That's a very complex situation. Either way, for our text, it's important to note, this land isn't filled with the Jews. And I believe it's actually of great significant theological import to note that. What we have here, subtly for sure, but what we have here is Jesus bringing the gospel, bringing his presence into Gentile territory. The calmer of the waves floats into Gentile land, where he will seek to bring peace and order. He will seek to bring restorative love. Now, this isn't explained by Mark. It takes calm, perceptive reading of the text. And remember back to all those parables that we just covered. That's exactly what Jesus has been calling for again and again. A calm, steady, perceptive understanding of the situation. I read a really, really neat book a few months back. It's called A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. It was written by a man by the name of George Saunders, who has long been the head of the creative writing department in Syracuse's graduate school for creative writing. And Syracuse has one of the great writing programs in the country. The book is basically Saunders letting you take one of his graduate classes on the Russian short story. He takes you inside the classroom and he teaches you through, just like you were in his class, seven great Russian short stories by the masters like Chekhov and Dostoevsky. Now, one exercise that Saunders does with his students, I started to incorporate into my own reading. And it has been absolutely fantastic. It's been a great addition. It's been a great teaching tool. He calls this little pedagogical tool, he calls it one page at a time. One page at a time. Whether I am reading a novel, a short story, a work of history, or the Bible, I will read a short section, usually one page, hence the title, One Page at a Time. With the Bible, I might go only three or four verses. And then after that, you stop. If it's a familiar text, like the Bible, you try to empty your mind of anything you might already know. And you ask yourself this question: what do I expect will happen next based solely on the information that I've been given? What do I expect will happen next based on the information that I've been given? What is the author setting a careful reader up to see? What is he setting us up to feel? What would be the moral thing to do next? Why are the details of the trees, of the landscape, of the location important? What are they telling me? Or what are they leading me to expect? You know, for good writers, they're always telling all those things. The landscape, the setting, the colors, the smile, the way the person's body is situated. For less than ideal writers, they might just be fluff. But that's why we don't read less than ideal writers. So I stop and I ask myself these questions. And the good writer then, they have one of two options. They can meet my carefully thought out assumptions, to which internally my heart, my soul says, yes, good, that makes sense. I'm following. That's what should happen next in the story. They can do that. Or, secondly, they can do something that subverts my expectations, which makes me say, wait, hold up. That's not what's supposed to happen next. Well, Jesus, as any real person would do, he often will meet our expectations, but just as often, he will radically subvert them. And he subverts them to the degree that the careful reader, when you're reading the gospel text, you should be constantly going, whoa, hold up. I did not see that coming. That's not the next step that I would take. As we've said, Jesus is elusive, right? He lives out of the age to come, for he is the life of the world to come. And as such, it often looks like he's jamming square pegs into round holes. But that's because the square pegs are supposed to be forming those round holes into square holes. That's what he's supposed to be doing. We have the wrong holes, and he's trying to fix those for us. So he's often thrusting those square pegs into round holes. And in our text today, he is doing that. He's doing that very subtly, but he's certainly doing that. If we were carefully reading through Mark, one page at a time, if you will, And we stopped after the story of the calming of the Sea of Galilee, where we were last week. And we ask ourselves, what do we expect Jesus to do next? What do we expect the new Israel? What do we expect the long-expected prophet? What do we expect David's son, yet David's Lord, to do after calming the sea? If we asked that, we'd probably say, well, he's going to go back to Jewish territory among the Jews, and they would start to celebrate the arrival of their kingdom. That's what we've been led to believe is going to happen. They have their king with them now, or at the very least, an incredible prophet, one who controls the weather. He's strong enough where they can certainly start to purge enemy oppression. This is the one that can give them that physical land that they're so focused on, that they really need, that they care about oh so much. But that's not what the slippery, elusive, ungraspable Jesus does. No, not at all. He doesn't go back to Jewish territory. He goes into Gentile territory. After all, we know this is Gentile territory because what type of animals are being kept in this land in our text? Right? They're keeping pigs. So the text doesn't have to tell you, hey, this is Gentile territory. It's a land full of thousands of pigs. So you don't need to be an expert in Jewish ceremonial law to realize a land full of pigs is not a land occupied by the Jews. Just like if one day we were to stumble across a land that was flooded with something like Super Bowl trophies, you would know and be certain that that's a land that was never occupied by the New York Jets. Right? You would know, right? This is basic analysis that we can do here. All right, a land of pigs is not the land of the Jews. So Jesus goes to the land of unclean pigs. He's in a land of tombs, a land of death, the height of uncleanliness. After all, if a Jew came into contact with a dead body or a dead person, they were marked off as ceremonially unclean. That's the area Jesus comes to. Then, immediately, Mark's favorite word again. Then immediately, he is encountered by a man with an unclean spirit. There is this outcast, this pariah, who lived among the tombs, amongst death, amongst all that to the Jews would be repulsive. And he is inexplicably drawn to Jesus, drawn in this case by fear. And this man is the most unclean thing possible. You can't imagine anything more unclean than this man. He's possessed by demons. He's naked. He's alone. He's outside of the town. He's thrashing himself, cutting himself. And he's lurking among the tombs surrounded by pigs. This man is an isolated individual. He's actually described in a very similar fashion to the way that Homer describes Polyphemus, the great Cyclops, in his Odyssey. The Cyclops was alone. He was isolated. He was angry. He lacked customs. He lacked norms. He lacked a communal language. And we need those things to thrive, right? To be fully human, we need language that we can share together. We need customs. We need norms. We need ceremonies. Because after all, we were made for life together. We're made for life together. And when we lack communal language and communal norms, we do not have life together. In a marvelous little book called The Apostles' Creed, Ben Myers writes these words. You'll find them as your quote of the week. Some of you, I'm sure, have already read them. Ben Myers writes this: the truest and most important things we can ever say are not individual words, but communal words. Most of the words of my life are trivial and fleeting. They fall from my lips and drift away like dead leaves. But in the creed, I am invited to say true words. In confessing the faith of the church, I allow my own individual I to become part of the eye of the body of Christ. It is then that I am saying something of deep and lasting importance. It is then that my words have roots. Well, this man, the demoniac, like the Cyclops, he has no community and he's got no communal words. Not only that, he is so disordered. He doesn't even have his own individual words. He doesn't even have his own voice, which is weak and frail and faulty like all of your individual words. But he doesn't even have that. In verse 9, Jesus asks his name, and he doesn't respond. The demon responds. The demon speaks. He says his name is Legion. He is many. A Roman legion would be upwards of 6,000 men. And just like the many Roman soldiers that had dispossessed the people of their homeland, so the many demons have dispossessed this man of his sanity, of his health, of his body. He has been dispossessed of the good life. He is unable to even identify himself or distinguish himself from those that have overrun his country. His country has been overrun by the legions of Rome, and he now can't even identify himself. In verse 10, the demon speaks again. Verse 10 reads, "And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country." And the demon begs Jesus earnestly, "Don't send me out of this country." You see, demons are reluctant to give up territory. And aren't we reluctant to give up the physical things as well? The things of this world. We cling to them dearly. So the demon begs not to be sent out of his country. He needs that spot in that land. After all, it's his. He's got inheritance rights to it. His tribe has been there for a long time. That's where I feel at home. Don't send me out of this land. But we see, as we just saw in the calming of the sea, that Jesus controls all territory. He not only controls the demon, but he controls the destination. And what does he do? He casts them out into the pigs, giving them over to their heart's desire. And when they're given over to their heart's desire, what do the pigs do? They run away from Jesus. You want the land? You want to control where you... Here, go into the pigs. And they ran away from Jesus, off the cliffs, drowning in the sea. As you can imagine, 2,000 pigs jumping into sea, that would cause quite a commotion. And the locals, they start popping up, wondering what is going on. Like, what after all is up with all the ruckus over there? That is a lot of noise. Verse 14. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. Let's stop there for a second. And let's take George Saunders one page at a time advice. What would we expect to happen here? These people hear of this commotion. They know there's this crazy demoniac thrashing himself, cutting himself, lurking among the tombs. They come back and he's calm. He's taken a shower. He's shaved. He's put on a nice pair of clothing. He's healed. You would expect they'd be bursting forth with faith, with joy, with happiness. The man has been restored. Wonder, joy, amazement. But that's not what happens. The opposite does. Verse 17. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. They began to beg Jesus to get out of there? He just restored everything. He just made it whole. He just took something ugly and made it remarkably beautiful, and they say, get out of here. You see, miracles are not enough for people. That's what the parables taught us too. So much depends on the ground, right? It depends on the openness, the willingness of the individual. It depends on the Spirit working in them, the ability to see through the miracle, past the miracle, to let their eyes rest properly on the one who performed the miracle. So the Gentile crowds, just like the Jews, they're unmoved. They're maybe even hardened by the miracle. And that's crushing. Jesus performs the miracle and they're hardened by it. But not so with the man. Not so with the former demoniac. Verse 18 is so beautiful. Verse 18. And as he was getting into the boat, that's Jesus getting into the boat. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. That guy sees. The Jews couldn't see. The Gentile crowds couldn't see. But this restored man, he sees and he loves Jesus. He isn't happy just to be healed and in his homeland, in his nation, back in whichever of the 10 tribes that he biologically came from. No, he feels already in his core, in his soul, that his home is with that man that healed me. His home is wherever Jesus is. He just wants Jesus, man. He just wants Jesus. And what does Jesus do? Well, he subverts our expectations yet again. Verse 19, he did not permit him. I want to go with you, Jesus. Jesus says, nope. He did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. This Jesus, who doesn't yet trust his own disciples, right? They have not yet been sent out. They have not been sent into the world. They certainly haven't been given the Great Commission yet. He doesn't trust them yet, but he trusts this guy. Jesus sends out Mr. Legion as sort of the first Christian missionary. That man has experienced a death and a rebirth. He was born of the Spirit. And Jesus says, go, my son, be my witness. I have faith in you. It's almost as if Jesus identifies with him. And after all, that should make some sense to us, as Jesus will very soon find himself isolated, alone, naked outside the city. He would find himself babbling what would seem like nonsense, random tidbits of the Psalms. He would find himself with the legions of demonic forces lured onto him. And like a hook, he hung right under the thumb of the Roman Empire. And that is how all demons were dealt with. That is how all uncleanliness was dealt with. That is how death and tombs were ultimately dealt with. That's how death died. Those are the very core facts of your salvation. They are the central facts of your salvation. But they are also the core of Christian ethics. We deal with ugliness, unfairness, filth, and injustice by self-denial, by costly, Christ-like love. That is the only way to bring healing. And if that is how the Son of God healed you, ought you to follow suit? John 13, 34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Amen.